Well, greetings again this afternoon. Did any of us remember to take a look at that little memory verse we gave you yesterday? Well, let's stand and say it. And if we need to, we'll say it more than once. Psalm 89, verse 15. Blessed is the people that know the joyful sound. They shall walk, O Lord, in the light of thy countenance. Some of you have. One more time. Blessed is the people that know the joyful sound. They shall walk, O Lord, in the light of thy countenance. It's not just the man like in Psalm 1, but it's the people of God that know the joyful sound. You may be seated. We'll say that again tomorrow. So we finished up yesterday talking about a little bit of how to make sense of all the music genres. Do we know what I mean by genre? A music style, okay? So if you're talking about rock and roll, you're talking about a specific genre. If you're talking about, there's just so many names out there nowadays. Genres of music. How do you make sense of all the different kinds of genres? I mean, there's Christian labels on so many types and styles of music. How do we make sense of all that? And we talked about that there's two streams of music in history and today, that being traditional European classical music versus popular music. And classical music being largely the product of the church in Europe. Now, when I say the church, I don't mean that true church that came all the way from the beginning, you know, the Waldensians and all those people. I'm just simply meaning the church age, the Catholic Church, Christian religion in Europe. The basic theology was worship of God, and classical music was a part of that. Now, music was used more than just for church. It was largely used for nobility. Okay, they didn't have recording then, of course. So you had to be where the musicians played. And so for the average people, that wasn't accessible to them in early years, you know, going back before the, you know, in the medieval and Renaissance. But for nobility, for kings, it was. And they would have secular music too, but you know what? Their secular music and their Christian, the church music was essentially the same. It sounded the same. Unfortunately, that's the true today with our popular music. But then it was very different. So one of the things as we went away from yesterday that I was just kind of wrestling with in my mind and just feeling a little bit, sometimes I say things in teaching or preaching that I'm just not sure if I said that quite right, and I want to be understood. And when I'm talking about classical, I just know that there's so many different things that come to people's minds. And I don't know what comes to your mind, and perhaps you're not even sure yourself. I am assuming that most of you here have a fairly good idea what I mean by just the general kind of broad brush classical definition. But there might be some of you who do not. And so I was thinking about that. Well, without going and playing a lot of different music to try to sum up many, many hundreds of years of history, I was thinking, well, is there something I could play or something I could show you that would kind of encapsulate? Well, there really isn't, because there's quite a bit of variety. But as I thought about that, I thought, well, if I had to pick something, it would probably be in the Baroque era. And of course, if we're going Baroque, Bach, of course. And I thought of Bach for a little bit, and I have the answer. Now, this isn't, like I said, there's nothing that would totally encompass everything, but this probably would best describe what comes to my mind when I think of something that's classical. And I chose something that's well-known, something that's not just vocal, even though that's wonderful, that's beautiful, lovely. It's not just instrumental, it's both. Decided I better actually clip it and not just decide when to turn it off, or next I would decide to let it play longer than I should. That's, if you don't know what I'm talking about, just think something like that. Classical, traditional music. The hymns we enjoy, Bach probably influenced the hymns we have more than any other person in history. In fact, he probably influenced all of music, or a lot of it, more than anyone else after him. All right. Popular music. I want to get into history today, and I'm going to have to keep moving because we have a lot of ground to cover, but we want to talk about popular music and see where its roots are. And the reason for this is so that you understand what we're dealing with in music today, because it's serious stuff. It's not just about, yeah, the rhythm's not too bad in that song. That one's probably okay. Listen, it's a very serious thing. I realize that we have to draw a line somewhere, and sometimes that can be difficult, but if we can learn to tell the difference of where the music I'm analyzing at the moment, what's influencing that, and I'll talk about this tomorrow, something I call the inspiration factor. I don't know if it's a good name for it or not, but I don't know the name for it, so that's what I call it. But when you're listening to a group singing, you should be thinking, where are they getting that inspiration from? The way they sing, or the way they play, who are they listening to? Nobody's original. Okay, sure, they might compose a song. They might sing it different than anyone else did. But our style, our whatever we choose to use, somewhere we're being influenced. We might come up with a certain thing that might be unique to us, but by and large, we're all greatly products of influence, and that's the same for musicians. So where's that influence come from? Anyway, I'm getting on to tomorrow's topics. Turn with me to Exodus chapter 32. We have a very familiar story here in Exodus 32, but there's something very interesting that we see here. It's the account of the golden calf. We're not going to read the whole story. Let's read verse 6. Exodus 32, verse 6 says, and this is talking about how they made the calf, and Aaron proclaimed a feast after they had set up the calf. And this is what it says in verse 6. And they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Let's jump now to verse 15. It says, and Moses turned. Moses is up on top of the mountain. They haven't seen him for many days. Moses turned and went down from the mount, and the two tables of the testimony were in his hand, and the tables were written on both their sides. One on the one side and on the other were they written. And the tables were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God graven upon the tables. And when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said unto Moses, there is noise of war in the camp. And he said, it is not the voice of them that shout for mastery, neither is it the voice of them that cry for being overcome, but the noise of them that sing do I hear. And it came to pass, as soon as he came nigh unto the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing, and Moses' anger waxed hot, and he cast the tables out of his hands and break them beneath the mount. This is a very sad scene. What kind of music were they making? Do you think it was clean, nice singing where they sang notes straight, and was there any rhythm involved? Well, there probably was some rhythm, but what kind of rhythm? We don't really know, but I'm guessing from what we see in history, there probably was some elements that we'll be talking about in that music. What was the body language? And that reminds me of something else I wanted to say about yesterday. And that is, sometimes when we do this kind of teaching, or maybe every time, there's maybe those that don't really know music rudiments real well, or you have that idea, you don't, or whatever it is. And so when we explain things like syncopation, that kind of thing, is like, oh, well, I don't really understand that. I can't hear that. I don't know. Listen, you don't have to get that, okay? Remember what I described about the body language? And when I said, I love Jesus, and I did it a bunch of different ways? All you have to do is listen to the body language of the music and honestly and openly analyze and say, is this music uplifting and ennobling? Or is it feeding the flesh? Is this rhythm syncopated and layered, or isn't it? I don't know. I can't hear that. Well, what if you tried dance to it? By yourself, of course. You know, is it something like, yeah, I can feel the rhythm? Or is it something that's going to make me start moving all kinds of ways that aren't appropriate, where I start swinging the lower part of my body around? If that's what it does, you probably have a layered syncopated rhythm. Anyway, is evil distinguishable from good by sound alone? Joshua and Moses They didn't hear any lyrics, or at least it doesn't say they did. But it sounded like war, at least initially. Yes, there is a discernible difference in the sound of music after the character of God or of pagan music. All right, history. History of popular music. We have to go back not real far. Only about 120, actually. We're going to go back 200 years, a little over 200 years to start. To New Orleans. New Orleans. I better get that correct. 1800s, the African slave trade bringing slaves to America is in full swing. 18th century, 19th century, all the way to the Civil War, which was in 1865. African slaves are brought from primarily West Africa, particularly two regions there in West Africa. What was going on there? Well, unlike Europe, in Africa, that part of Africa, it was paganism. Tribal people, ancestral worship, that was their culture. Very unfortunate. But that's what it was. Voodoo. And probably voodoo is not a new word to any of us because we've been around people or been involved with missions for years in Africa or in Haiti. So we know a little bit of what that means. John H. Steele, in his book, World of the Unexplained, says this, quote, "The follower of voodoo seeks to incorporate a law, that's a god, into himself by writhing and leaping through a dance while drummers bang out complex rhythms. When just the right rhythm is found for an individual law, the dancer takes it up and the law enters his soul. The religion is strictly Dionysian or sensual or pagan." Complex rhythms, polyrhythms, that's what he's talking about. Michael Ventura, and listen carefully to this. This man writes he's very educated. But I don't believe this man's a Christian. And I don't think he's even trying to critique popular music in a negative way. And I'm going to quote from him numerous times. The things he says are astounding. If only Christians would be willing to recognize the things that he points out. Many are, but many aren't. He writes about culture. Quote, "Africans don't conceive of the other world, the world of the spirit, the divine, as existing above this one or below it, or even alongside it. Neither heaven nor hell, nor Olympus, nor Hades, nor the Australian Dreamtime. For the African, the human world and the spirit world intersect. Their sign for this is the cross, but it has nothing to do with the Christianist cross, which impales a man in helpless agony upon the intersection. That is what the West feels. In Africa, the crosses of two roads intersecting to flow into each other, to nourish each other. The earthly and the spirit world meet at right angles, and everything that is most important happens at the spot where they meet, which is neither solely of one world or the other." Get this. "The metaphysical goal of African Way is to experience the intense meeting of both worlds at the crossroads." Are you following what he's saying? He's talking about spiritual. Going on. "Spurred by the holy drums, deep in the meditation of dance, one is literally entered by a god or a goddess. Goddesses, man to men, gods, man to women. Westerners call this possession. That's too crude of a concept for this. Though good writers describe the phenomenon, though good writers describing the phenomenon have been forced to use it, we have no other word or concept that comes close. But instead of possession, it seems more accurate to think of a flowing through. One flows through the other. The body literally becomes the crossroads. Human and divine are united within it, and it can happen to anyone. Another quote from the same Michael Ventura says, in Haitian voodoo, as in Africa, the drum is holy. The drummer is seen merely as the servant of the drum. He has no influence within the hierarchy of the religion, but through his drum, he has great influence on the ceremony. Each lao prefers a fundamentally different rhythm, and the drummer knows them all and all their variations. He can often invoke possession by what he plays, unquote. Richard Hodges, quote, each percussive or vocal part has a slightly different rhythm which coincides with and sometimes crosses the other rhythms or the guiding pulse at strategic moments. The drummers often shuffle their feet or sway their bodies in a dance-like motion to assist them in maintaining contact with the main beat, especially when the rhythm is syncopated. During these rituals that still take place in the Congo and Yorubaland, that's the areas where the slave came from, the intricate layers of the multiple rhythmic drumming are considered the primary source of occult power, unquote. A voodoo priestess said this, the rhythm is more important than the words. Our gods respond to the rhythm above all else. So if we understand what's going on here, in African voodoo worship, the goal is possession. But it might not even be like what we think of getting possessed by a demon. That's what it is. But they have a concept that is so foreign to us of the body and what it means to feel. I have a clip of voodoo rhythm, and I don't relish the thought at all of playing this, okay? Because this is demonic, okay? But I'm going to play it because, well, here it is. Those layers, syncopated rhythms, it was a lot of it, it was very fast. Now, I want to be clear, Africa is not the only place that this kind of thing happens. We can go all over the world to people, to tribal people, people that worship ancestors, worship the sun, worship nature, whatever. And we'll find similar things. We can go to Russia, we can go to Japan, India, Latin America. We can go to find the Native Americans. And yes, even in Europe, the Celts, Scotland, that area. Tribal people with ancestor worship type practices. And guess what? they all come up with something that sounds, it's all usually mostly rhythmic, and it's drumming, something similar to voodoo. How did that happen? Why is it that when man worships the devil, he plays polyrhythms? It's a fact. We can witness it all over the world. Well, African slaves were brought to America very unjustly, and they brought their voodoo music with them. Now, in the American colonies, the United States as a young nation, or before that, the colonists heard the voodoo, they saw what the Africans did with a drum, and they said, no, that's not going to work. And they took their drums, wouldn't allow them to have them. They didn't allow the slaves to gather together from multiple owners. Generally, there might have been some exceptions, but this effectively suppressed voodoo. Now, I don't think it was actually voodoo that they were concerned about. They were concerned about slaves revolting. And they saw that the drum and this practice brought them together, and that there was spirit involved in it. And so they put a stop to that, as best they could anyway. Now, that doesn't mean it didn't survive. The Africans kept their rhythms alive by dancing, by clapping, by singing. The tap dance was invented. By them. But in New Orleans, everything was different. New Orleans is a port town down there, bottom of the Mississippi River. Active in the slave trade, the Louisiana Territory belonged to the French, and then the Spanish, and then it became the French again. I forget how many years that was that it was ruled by the French. But the French and the Spanish, in general, have always been more lenient on their slaves. They didn't have quite the regulation, and they didn't give their slaves near the hard time that the colonists would have. The colonists were Church of England, Protestant. The French, Catholic. Made a big difference in how they handled this. The slaves were forced to become Catholic, which they did. And they were allowed, or at least it happened, whether it was supposed to or not, they would get together. They would practice their drum rhythms. This was the case in other French colonies as well. Saint-Domingue, or what you would know today as Haiti, on the island of Hispaniola, that was also a French colony, and voodoo was thriving in what we know today as Haiti, amongst the slaves with the French. Well, that all changed, or no, it didn't necessarily change, but things really did change in 1791 when the slaves in Saint-Domingue revolted against their French owners and began the Haitian Revolution. And for 13 years, there was fighting in Haiti. And what happened to this during those times? Well, there was French people, free blacks, French that still had some slaves under the control that fled out of away from that island, and they went, many of them went, to New Orleans. Some went to places like Cuba, Spanish colonies there. Excuse me. Significant immigration to New Orleans. And this caused a significantly sharp rise in voodoo during the time of the Haitian Revolution. Well, in 1804, the blacks in Haiti shocked everyone by pushing out Napoleon Bonaparte's, the French army, out of Haiti and had their own state set up, and we know it as Haiti today. Well, this was scary for whites in the colonies, whether it was the British or the French, the Spanish, to see a slave revolt that was successful. So the Spanish in Cuba, all the ones that had fled there, they pushed them out very shortly thereafter. Guess where most of them went? To New Orleans. What was going on in New Orleans? Well, in New Orleans, the revolution, the Haitian Revolution, ended in 1804. The Louisiana Purchase was in 1803. If you remember your history, the Americans that were just had taken possession of New Orleans were in no political position to deal with the ethnic challenges in New Orleans. There was French, there was Spanish, there was free blacks. More than anywhere else, there was free blacks because they could easily purchase their freedom in the French colonies. There was Celtic people. It was probably one of the most mixed places in this part of the globe at that time. That was a challenge. And we have this rising voodoo practice. There was revolts that happened, but none of them got real far. And over the next years, there were laws and ordinances put in place to deal with this problem, this constant possible threat of the blacks revolting. And finally, in 1817, slaves, the mayor of New Orleans, said that the slaves and the blacks, free blacks included, could only gather in one place to do their voodoo and to play their drums, to play their music, rather than being all scattered around where they couldn't see them. He wanted it out in the open. So there was a field there called Congo Square. And so for almost 60 years, African music and voodoo was happening right in the open, right in the middle of New Orleans, in a place called Congo Square, through the majority of the 1800s. Large crowds of slaves gathered in groups from miles around. Whites would gather and watch. Travelers from across the United States experienced it. Henry Edward Durrell observed Congo Square and wrote in 1853, "Let a stranger to New Orleans visit of an afternoon of one of its holy days the public squares in the lower portion of the city, and he will find them filled with its African population, excuse me, trickled out with every variety of show, costume, joyous, wild, and in full exercise of real Saturnalia. Upon entering the square, the visitor finds the multitude packed in close, narrow circles of a central area of only a few feet, and there in the center of each circle sits the musician, astride a barrel, strong-headed, which he beats with two sticks to a strange measure incessantly, like mad, for hours together, while the perspiration literally rolls in streams and wets the ground. And there labor the dancers, male and female, under an inspiration of possession, which takes from their limbs all sense of weariness and gives to them a rapidity and a duration of motion that will hardly be found elsewhere outside of mere machinery. The head rests upon the breast or is thrown back upon the shoulders, the eyes closed or glaring, while the arms, amid cries and shouts and sharp ejaculations, flood upon the air, or keep time with the hands patting the thighs to a music which seems eternal. Now, many of us I know can picture that scene because we've been exposed to African Haitian missions. But you have to understand that to this man, Henry Durwell, and to many whites in America, this is different. Well, there's an interesting transition that began to happen in Congo Square. The music of voodoo became less about ceremony and more about entertainment, because more and more there's a crowd gathering to watch what's going on. I'll quote Michael Ventura again. He says, "In the centuries of voodoo, there is no ceremonies of voodoo, there is no audience. Some may dance and some may watch, but those roles may change several times in a ceremony, and all are participants. In Congo Square, African music was put into a Western form of presentation. From 1817 until the early 1870s, these dances went on with few interruptions. The dance and music focused upon their own for their own sake by both participants and spectators. It is likely that this was the first time blacks became aware of the music as music instead of strictly as part of ceremony, which means that in Congo Square, African metaphysics first became subsumed in the music, a secret within the music instead of the object of the music," unquote. So elements of European music get mixed in with the sounds of African drumming and voodoo. The gatherings at Congo Square eventually stop in 1875. But the seed of popular music, you remember the two streams that I put on the board yesterday? I should have put them up here today. We had traditional, classical, and popular. The seed of popular music, the source of the stream, had been planted and was about to sprout. Well, that brings us to the turn of the century, 1900. Gifted African musicians creating music for the sake of enjoyment, they're just entertaining, mix more and more traditional European elements with African rhythms and other elements as well. And around the turn of the century, 1800, three new genres of music burst out like a flood. And we're going to talk about those three, but one other thing I want to point out is that in 1877, Thomas Edison invented the phonograph. That was the first machine. It was pretty archaic, but the first machine that you could put a cylinder on there and crank that thing and speak into it, and it would do its thing mechanically, and then you could crank it and it would play back to you. It was pretty, well, we would probably think it pretty pathetic then. But that was a big deal. And by 1930, that has changed a lot. We now had microphones, we had speakers, amplifiers, we had vinyl record recordings that were not too bad. They cracked and popped a little bit, all by 1930. Amazing. Just in time for everything that I'm going to tell you about. Well, the first genre that kind of popped up and became popular was ragtime. What's ragtime? Well, it's mostly a piano genre, 1890s. And if you see somebody playing, it might not always be ragtime if you see this, but typically the left hand is bouncing back and forth between a low note and the chord, low note, chord, low note, chord. Bum, 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 bum. And the right hand of the pianist, mostly a piano genre, is playing syncopated rhythms. Scott Joplin is known as the king of ragtime. And he's famous, or one of his songs he's famous for, is this one, which you may very well recognize. Maybe you even play it. I don't know. The Entertainer. So, I always say that sounds like an ice cream truck. But that music became popular. All right, now listen to this. This is his most famous piece, composed in 1899, called Maple Leaf Rag. I'm going to let this one play a little bit longer. It's played a little bit more like ragtime usually was, faster. And listen, you have that low bump, 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 but then you have the right hand doing all kinds of syncopated rhythms. Body language of that, not just that last section there, the whole way through. Da, 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 da. Okay? This is the start of American popular music. Okay? It might seem like, oh, hey, it's just some jamming on the piano. Hey, if you play The Entertainer or something, that's okay. I recommend that you, before you go find a lot of other ragtime pieces, you learn to enjoy something else. But I'm not going to hold that against you. In fact, if you played it for me, I would enjoy it, especially if you could play it that fast. But the Maple Leaf Rag here. But that's the beginning. It's not voodoo music, but it's got some elements. It's the beginning. All right, I got to keep moving. Blues. Blues, what's the blues? Mostly blues, it varied some, but the primary type of blues was a black with a guitar, okay? And Although instrumental accompaniment is almost universal in the blues is essentially a vocal form. Blues songs are lyrical rather than narrative. Blues singers are expressing feelings rather than telling stories. The emotion expressed is generally one of sadness or melancholy, often due to problems of love, but also oppression and hard times. To express this musically, blues performers use vocal techniques such as melisma, which means sustaining a single syllable across several pitches, rhythmic techniques such as syncopation, and instrumental techniques such as choking or bending guitar strings on the neck or applying a metal slide or bottleneck to the guitar strings to create a whining voice-like sound. So we're going to listen to a clip of, and it's a new recording, of someone playing in Delta blues styles, which would have happened in about the 1930s. And they take a, you've probably seen this already, in those days they would have broke a beverage bottle and put the neck over their finger so that they could use that as a slide. Now there's all kinds of slides made for that purpose. Listen to the sliding around. What's the body language of that? Something sensual. Robert Johnson. Robert Johnson. There's a legend about this man. It was an African American, and he wanted to be a bluesman. Or maybe it wasn't quite even blues at that time. They were playing probably more ragtime band type thing, and he wanted to learn the guitar, and he was trying and couldn't. This is legend. Don't know for sure if this is true or not. And it's the legend goes to say that he went to the crossroads, a crossroad, and they have a crossroad in Mississippi that supposedly this may have happened. Went to the crossroad and made a deal with the devil. Sold a soul in exchange for mastery of the guitar. The story is that he came back, and he was only a young man, early 20s, came back as one of the most influential musicians of popular music of all time. He only played for about 6 years, and he mysteriously died. Probably was actually killed. That's the legend. Here's what, let's see, I don't want to lose my spot here. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they put him in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It says, his playing was to die for, or at the very least, to sell your soul to Satan for. Legend has it that Robert Johnson met the devil at the crossroads. Remember we were hearing about the crossroads earlier, and gave his soul in exchange for mastery of the guitar. Steeped in mystery, killed mysteriously, his legend eclipsed only by his skill. Robert Johnson may be the first ever rock star. That's what the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has to say about Robert Johnson. Well, here's a song, an actual recording of Robert Johnson. This is in the 1830s. You would think if it was that demonic, it would have been a whole lot more beady. I went to the crossroads, fell down on my knees. That sound right there, my friends, laid the groundwork for rock and roll. We have the basics of the rhythm starting. It don't feel like much. And we got an awful lot of slipping around in both the playing and in the singing. The pop music industry knows that. There's another song he sang. We won't play it. But it's the lyrics. Did you hear the lyrics of this song, by the way? I went down to the crossroad, fell down on my knees. Would support the legend. I don't know. He has another song. It says, me and the devil walking side by side. His songs are full of that kind of idea. All right, well, blues music. Oh, here's a quote by Robert Johnson I want to give you. He said, this sound, my music, did something to women that caused them to do stuff I didn't understand, but I liked it. This is serious stuff. Blues music glorified drinking, womanizing, gambling, drugs, violence, and it was called in those days the devil's music. And perhaps it's still called that today by those that really know the truth. So the blues were making their way all through the South, and particularly in New Orleans. Ragtime was there in New Orleans. And suddenly, specifically in New Orleans, springs up another genre. What happens when we put ragtime and blues together? It's a little bit more than just that, but we get jazz. Jazz, a music form often improvisational, developed by African Americans and influenced by both European harmonic structure and African rhythms. It was developed partially from ragtime and blues and is often characterized by syncopated rhythms, polyphonic ensembles playing varying degrees of improvisation, often deliberate deviations of the pitch. Now, the word improvisation, I want to point that out, because improvising, do we know what improvising is? Improvising is if we're singing a song and you don't know the song and you're just making up your own tenor line or whatever, you're improvising. You're kind of being a composer as we go. Improvising on the go is a cornerstone of pop music. It's not the only place it happens. It can happen here in church and be perfectly, well, now I better take that one back. If you're careful with it, it might be all right. Just don't get too carried away. Well, here's a clip of New Orleans jazz as it would have been played back in the 1810s, 1820s. This is a modern group of jazz players, but they're purposefully playing it New Orleans style so that you can know what it sounded like back then. And it's a song you'll recognize. And by the way, they can take any song. Jazz players sit down together. It doesn't matter what instruments they have. It doesn't matter how classical of instruments they have there. Whatever they play, brass, woodwinds, whatever. Take a song, and they have their specific basic rules of how many measures we do this chord, that chord. That's why they talk about 16 bar, 12 bar. And they improvise and make up their own lines. Oops, I'm sorry. Here it is. Are you getting a little bit more of that heavier rhythm coming through now? Hear all that slipping and sliding going? If you didn't hear it in the other instruments, hopefully you at least heard it in that lead trumpet. I mean, he's just bow, 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 bow. when the saints go marching in. Well, jazz has this rhythm, and maybe I should have pointed it out to you before I played that, called swing rhythm. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I'm not going to take the time to try to explain it theoretically, because guess what? Jazzers themselves can't explain what it is. It's so slightly offbeat that no one can quite tell where it is, but you got to feel it, is what they all say. You got to feel the rhythm. And they call it swing. And it actually birthed the whole genre of jazz. It's a jazz subgenre called swing. Big band swing. And this was really popular 1930s, 40s. Here's a clip of a very popular swing piece. This is an actual recording in the 1930s. Did you hear those lyrics? It ain't worth a thing if it ain't got that swing. And later on it says, just keep that rhythm and give it all you got. You hear all that sliding around, the brass instruments, they take a mute and they hold it over the bellows of the trumpet or the trombone or whatever it is, and they're wow, wow, wow. All right? They actually use the end of a toilet plunger. That's what it is. I actually looked them up online, and this music store seller was selling all the different kinds of mutes. And they were explaining each different kind, and they say, in this one here, we don't have one because you can find one at any hardware store you go to. It's amazing what creativity comes up with. Here's an interesting quote I ran across. Swing woke up the American body. Why did it say that? Because in the 1930s, 40s, dancing. Okay, you have to understand it was the age of the Depression, the Great Depression, okay? There was a lot of frustration. America, especially the young people, took that frustration out in dancing to swing. And I found a note, I don't know who wrote it, that said, swing woke up the American body. I don't know about you, but I don't want my body woke up. Over the next few decades, blues and jazz produced numerous subgenres, and then in 1950s comes this sound.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock.
It's not a black fella anymore.
We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your bad bags on. Join me home. We'll have some fun when the bad bags.
Feel the body language. If you were gonna move to it, what kind of moves? Rock and roll. 1950s. That's only 50 years, folks. We went from the blacks doing their thing to now rock and roll, which is, there was some black rock and rollers, but they actually, the blacks tend to like their blues. And they went to more of a rhythm and blues, which I'll play a little bit later. But whites like this man, Bill Haley and the Comets, rock and roll. The African music, can you hear that coming through clear and strong now? That voodoo drumming rhythm. All right, Little Richard. Little Richard was an early rock and roller. He said this, "My true belief about rock and roll is this. I believe this kind of music is demonic. A lot of the beats in music today are taken from voodoo, from the voodoo drums. If you study music and rhythms like I have, you will see this is true." Listen, in the secular pop world, it's no secret. The musicians that are serious about their art, that study, like he did only 50 years later, that studied to see where their music come from, they all openly admit that, yeah, this is demonic stuff. Many of them do. That was only the 1950s. What would Little Richard say about the music we have today if the music he was playing in 1950 was demonic? Well, then there was Elvis Presley, king of rock and roll. He became the leading figure, and I'm quoting Christian Berdahl. Some of you might be familiar with his teaching. He became the leading figure of the new love sound of rock and roll. His suggestive stage antics made him enormously popular and controversial. He brought together country, pop, and rhythm and blues in a way that had not been done before. At Elvis's live shows, the influence on the audience became increasingly fevered. Reports stated he'd start out, "You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog," that's a song, and they'd go to pieces. This is news reporting. They'd go to pieces. They'd always react the same way. There would be a riot every time. That is no joke. That is seriously how it was. Screaming. Here it is.
"You ain't nothing but a hound dog. You're crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Crying all the time. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit and you ain't no friend of mine."
Well, what's the result of this? This is 1950s. We go into the 1960s. 1960s, we have a counter youth culture like this country had never seen before. Rebellion against parents, against government, against anything traditional. Continuing to quote Christian Berdahl. Says, "More than anyone else, Elvis gave the young a belief in themselves as a distinct and somehow unified generation, the first in America to feel the power of an integrated youth culture." The body language of rock and roll is this: do what you want to do. Whatever feels good, do it. 1960s, drugs became a big problem in our major cities for the first time. Now, it was a problem before, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't everywhere. But after this, it was. The book, Why Johnny Can't Tell Right from Wrong, and What We Can Do About It, by William Kilpatrick, a professor at Boston College, says this: "Rock confirms their," that means the young people's, "right to have and express strong sensual emotions. The message is your feelings are sacred and nothing is set above them. This in its essence, is all that rock is about. He goes on, rock can't be made respectable. The music will simply subvert the words. No matter how many reforms are attempted, rock and rap will always gravitate in the direction of violence and uncommitted sex. The beat says, do what you want to do. I quoted earlier Christian Berdahl saying that Elvis Presley's stage antics were controversial, but also loved at the same time. He had a way of moving around, swooning the microphone, and when I say moving, a lot of moving around, that was so sensual. And Michael Ventura says about that, that the girls instantly knew the language of the music and the movement and screamed for more, and they screamed. Well, I'm not going to go my history I'm covering of popular secular pop music is 1900 mainly 19 to this point rock and roll. I don't see any point in going further into secular music and just exposing more and more and more hideous evil. But I tell you, it gets lots worse. Lots worse. The sad thing is that all those styles of music have somewhere you can find the same thing with a Christian label on it. Maybe not all of them, but most of them. One more clip I want to play. And this goes back to the blues. Now, this is blues after rock and roll, okay? But it's still the blues style by B.B. King. And I want to play this because B.B. King is really famous for the way he played his guitar and the way he would bend the strings as he played. I don't think he real often used the slide, but he would bend the strings. He, on his own admission, wasn't that great at playing chords, but he was really good at picking a melody and making it sound very sensual. B.B. King said this, "The women reacted with their bodies flowing to the rhythm coming out of my guitar." And you'll hear that, you'll hear the bending strings. That's what I want you to hear. He's playing the lead guitar, okay? Now there's a bunch of rhythm. Remember, this is now electric guitars, everything else. So we have that rhythm going on. We've talked about that enough. You can just kind of push that out of your mind for the moment. And I want you to listen to that lead guitar, that melody playing, because that's what B.B. King, if you can picture, he's on a stage and he's playing that before he starts singing the song while he has the bass guitar and the drum set backing him up. Listen to how he plays. Hear that pitch bending? Bending them strings. I had to play that because that illustrates perfectly both elements of popular music that I've been talking about. We have the rhythm, of course. Syncopated polyrhythms, and we have that sliding bending. And B.B. King says that it did something to the women. Did something to the men, too. I Well, we've been talking about secular music. What about Christian music? And we're not going to go there today. That's for tomorrow. Christian music. How do we discern? How do we take? Because like I said, classical music, popular music, we have anything you want with a Christian label on it. In fact, you can go to websites and places where they'll say, you know, if you like Elvis Presley or you like whatever secular musician, you like this in Christian music. It's so sad. Why, when we have such a wealth of wonderful music, like the piece I played at the beginning, and maybe your father says he doesn't want instruments, and if that's fine, if that's so, that's fine. Respect him for that. There's lots of wonderful a cappella music. I listen to instruments. I can enjoy that piece we heard earlier, but there's a whole wealth. We don't need the influence of popular music. I feel like it would just be good just to sing a song, just to kind of get that dirt off. Let's just sing Lift Your Glad Voices. Stand up with me, would you? Oh, lift your glad voices in triumph on high.